Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Christopher Lazarsky, professor of politics and history at Lazarsky University, about his new book, Lord Acton for Our Time. Almost everyone is familiar with Lord Acton's most famous quote, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." In Lord Acton for Our Time, Christopher reintroduces modern readers to Acton's ideas, especially his theories of liberalism. Christopher, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me here.
Of course. Lord Acton is a really fascinating figure, but he's also one that I don't think a lot of modern readers are familiar with, though he's had so much influence on many thinkers that people are familiar with. But before going into the book, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, since you introduced me already, I'm professor of politics and history, so I will go directly to my background. I did my major on Greco-Roman history, which at the time I did not expect, but certainly helped me to focus and understand Acton. And my college years coincided with communist Poland, and during that time I became involved in anti-communist opposition. I was an underground publisher, so in a sense, at that time I thought a lot and discussed a lot with my colleagues about liberty, what it means, why some nations are enjoy freedom and some may not. At that time, we were unhappy to be among those latter cases. And in a sense, although I haven't heard about Acton at that time, I was prepared to be open to him. If I may continue, in December 1981, martial law was introduced in Poland, and then I ended up in prison, as many thousands of solidarity activists. But again, unexpectedly, owing to that that unpleasant occurrence, I could leave Poland. Having American visa, refugee visa, and being legally in the United States, and spent in the United States next 12 years. This is how I became because this was 1985, I became the PhD student at Georgetown University, where I majored in Russian and Soviet history. That has nothing to do with Acton. At that time, I was more interested in history of those who occupied Poland. And in a sense, if you again ask me about my background, I can trace my interest to Acton to Georgetown. I was really lucky to have among my teachers Father Professor James Shaw. I took his course on political theory, and I remember specifically one class devoted to Acton. He then asked us to read several of his essays, and this guy instantly fascinated me. I couldn't understand him, I sensed that this is a man that has some important thoughts on liberty.
How did you come to write this particular book?
Well, this particular book is not the first one I wrote on Acton. In fact, I wrote three books on Acton. This is my third book. Two of them are in English, were in English, right in English. And again, I would say that that Father Shaw played some role. I remember a discussion I had with him a long time after I have graduated. I met him in 2001, and at that time I was really leaving the Soviet studies and focus more and more on political theory, and I asked him whether Acton is really worthy of focusing, and Shaw said definitely do it, and that resulted in my first book that I published in 2012, this one is a much more mature book. Okay, I tell to tell you the truth, Acton is a very complex thinker. His thought is not easy to grasp, and it took me many years to understand him. Whether I'm right or not in his interpretation, that's another story, but I interpreted him in certain ways, though still 10 years ago I was not sure, or I probed certain things. I put certain theses about him, and I did not encounter a protest as far as my interpretation of Acton. And this one was just this book. Well, it was a proposal to write on Acton for our time. I mean, and I thought that that would be a nice completion when I have no longer doubts, but in a sense I can state certain things in more clear way and be more open about it.
And this book is a good introduction to Acton as well. You cover the overview of his ideas, but also his biography. For listeners, would you tell us a little bit about Lord Acton's youth and young adulthood?
Okay. Well, Acton, when we hear the term Lord, we think that, well, someone is born with a silver spoon and in his mouth and has life easy. Everything is given to him. This is not the case of Lord Acton. His father died when he was 3 years old. His mother remarried and was thoroughly devoted to her new husband. So he left 3 years old, future Lord Acton, in the care of her Italian grandmother. He came from a cosmopolitan background, you know. He has, relatives in France, Germany, Italy. Actually, Father Shaw introduced him to me as saying that he's a German, which I disagree. Actually, he's not a German, but certainly he had a German blood in himself. So he was without parental care. Especially mother's care, you know, that his youth was not very nice, I would say. He spent, when he was six or so, I don't remember right now, maybe seven, he was sent to boarding school, first in France, then in England. Then they changed the school. Of course, his mother paid for everything, so you could say she did her job, but his letters to her at that time are really heartbreaking, you know, that when he begs her, take me out and take me out from here. Anyway, his more mature years, when he became a college student, although college students should be put in quotation marks. He studied at the University of Munich, but in fact, he was under the care of Father Dollinger. So he had a private tutor. He just took two courses at the University of Munich. And that, but in Munich, he found finally a family life. You know, he had relatives, German relatives from Arco Valley, and they, this was a family, if I'm not mistaken right now, having seven children. And so they treated him as one of their own, and he finally, you know, found a family life. His life was childhood and early adulthood was not very pleasant, difficult, I would say. Oh, one thing, why he ended up in Munich? He was not admitted to Oxford and Cambridge because he was Catholic.
So in his more adult, mature life, how were his ideas and work received? How did they develop? You know, what was his general, how would you define the general scope of his adulthood before we get into his ideas?
From the beginning, you know, he had sort of achieved a liberal education. He had, he was lucky, actually, having Dollinger, Father Dollinger. He was a Catholic priest who really took care about his education. Well, I'm not sure, you know, I prefer myself to have few students instead of one. But perhaps, you know, if you focus on one student, that's another story. Dollinger was, a German. So he organized his life starting from, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning and going to sleep at 10 or 11 p.m. Everything was every half an hour or an hour. He was supposed to do this, this, and this. Very strict schooling. And Dollinger introduced him to really grand masters of liberal thought, but specific liberal thought first. Alexis de Tocqueville and Edmund Burke. So this made Acton to be a specific liberal, not a typical liberal, specific liberal. That is the one that values tradition. And this is more sort of the impact of Burke doesn't like abstract principles, such as, you know, well, since everyone is born equal, we're supposed to enforce equality regardless of the cost. He hated abstract principles.
And once Acton was starting to get a little older, aging, was he? Did he become famous in his lifetime, or was he more of a someone that was discovered later?
I should add that, you know, in Munich, he became very enthusiastic about Catholic teaching. So his idea, his main idea at that time was to reconcile the Catholic Church with liberalism, which is, I mean, this idea made no sense at all if one knows what was the church like at that time and what was the liberal mainstream at that time. Somehow, Acton thought that this is his mission. Let us remember that he was a Catholic in England, and 19th century England, still until the 70s. Of the 19th century, had many anti-Catholic laws that prevented Catholics from holding offices, and that was one of the reasons he ended up studying in Munich. But ACTON, and that we touch another problem, was a different kind of liberal. He was not a liberal of what we understand right now as a typical liberal. In one of the advantages I had, or what ACTON taught me, and I was not aware before I encountered him, is that in 19th century, there were two liberalisms, not just one, and that he represented one current that at that time, who knows, perhaps was the mainstream. But this is that current of liberalism that lost and is no longer considered to be liberalism or to be liberal. And perhaps this explains, justifies why he thought that the true liberalism, which has respect for tradition, could easily reconcile liberalism with Catholicism.
How would you broadly then go about defining Acton's understanding of liberalism as a liberalism that has respect for tradition, as a conservative liberalism? What type of liberalism does he represent? And why did he latch on, still hold on to this term liberalism?
Why he kept that term and did not invade anyone else? I don't know. That's something which is puzzling, because I can't imagine. I mean, this is a mystery which I did not resolve. The guy had a brilliant mind, really brilliant mind. I mean, imagine he studied one book a day, and this was not just easy reading, but he wrote notes, and he had a really excellent memory. So we can think that throughout his lifetime he read 60,000-70,000 books, not just read as we read novels, but read history books. So his knowledge was enormous. I mean, this is one of the reasons. This is I did not address this question, but when you asked earlier in this interview why I focus on Acton, I have no chance to read so many books as he did. My knowledge is secondary. I just take advantage of what he did. I of course treat him as a genuine thinker. I don't think he attempted to deceive us. He was a really honest man, and he was trying his best to pass on his knowledge to us. Now, what kind of liberal he was? He was, as he described himself, ardent liberal. I mean, he wrote in one of his letters to, well, it doesn't matter really, the person that was his female recipient, that he treats liberalism as a religion. He associated liberalism with the best in human history. Whatever we associate with progress, what is positive, just, this was his liberalism. So, as he said, it's his faith, and he hated conservatism. That's an interesting thing. It's a funny thing when I hesitated in my first book, the current one we discuss, I avoided that topic at all, in general, I interpret him as a conservative liberal, although I realize he would have hated that, you know, that would insult him, that he was a conservative. Conservatism was for him an expletive, you know, someone who is stupid. He sometimes uses that term, a stupid conservative, stupid Tory. So This is puzzling, but I guess, I mean, let us remember he lived in Victorian England. Liberalism was triumphing, and he considered himself to be one of those guys who shapes it. The thing which I put in my book is that no one questioned his liberalism. I mean, the guy attacked liberalism at its core, its fundamental principles, but there was no voice, at least I know of, which would say, look, Lord Acton, you are not liberal because you question certain fundamental principles that belong to liberal dogma. No. All said, he was quintessential liberal. No, so I take this at his face value. He was liberal, yet he was a different liberal, and that's if I may continue, this liberalism is completely different. And I mean this was the problem which I really wrestled during my first book, because I was so uncertain of myself. But then I discovered there are two liberalism. That is one which is continental, that can be traced to Franco-German philosophical, political thought, that appeals to abstract principles, you know, that goes back to something which, by the way, the English invented, Hobbes, stating, you know, state of nature, then we are free and equal. But somehow this idea was flourished more on the continent, or they did not eclipse what existed in the UK and especially in America. That is liberalism of which Acton talked. That is liberalism which has roots in existing order, England and America, especially America. England would have to be explained additionally. But in America, there was no question that the colonists who came to America were equal. Yes, there were those servants who were paid and had temporary advantages, but ultimately all white settlers who belong to any parish were treated as equal and participated in decision making. First in the parish, then in the town, county level, and that grew, you know, there are like concentric circles, parish, county, town, county, colony, and ultimately the union. So this was a grassroots liberalism where people were equal and free, and they decided about their fortune. In England, that was a little bit more complicated because they have this medieval roots. Therefore, Englishmen was this is something which I discovered in spite of, you know, I did my master's and then PhD at Georgetown. No one told me, Acton told me, that actually throughout the Middle Ages and early modern age, the rights of Englishmen, the rights of Frenchmen, the rights of Dutchmen included those who were considered to be citizens, which were very narrow group. In England, by the end of 18th century, that was about 3% of the population. They were citizens. Okay, still, they had their rights to elect a parliament. In the United States, suffrage was much more common, widespread. Well, in 19th century, it embraced roughly about 80% of the population. That's really, I mean, male population, of course. That was a much widespread. And this is what Acton says: this is liberalism, having grassroots originates in a given polity, England, United States, but he traced it to antiquity. I don't want how much you want to go to history, but I can explain that if you are interested in it. Anyway, so this is different liberalism, which we could call it by the term which von Hayek used, that is evolutionary, and which I call it organic. Why organic? Because Acton uses metaphors that are clearly organic, saying that liberty grows like a language or grows like a tree, like a flower. So it's an organic growth, starts from original roots. Of course, they have to have certain basic principles like equality. And that is why he traces liberalism, the roots of liberalism, to Israel and or ancient Greece. Israelites, ancient Israelites, were equal because they were brothers and sisters, yes? They belonged to the same tribe. They did not elect their authorities, but their authority was organic. The elders were the one who had power. It's like, you know, today we send the youth to school when they acquire knowledge. In antiquity, who was the one who had the most knowledge? The older guy, yes? The one who was capable to survive 50 years, 60 years, so he had more experience than the young one. And authority naturally rested with him. In Greece, the situation was better because ancient Greeks recognized equality and moreover gave them the right to decide. They voted, you know, they were citizens. So to complete, Acton's liberalism assumes active citizens who decide about their own affairs and elect magistrates, decides about the policies, and in a sense, the difference between continental liberalism that appeals to Abstract's principle, you know, we are free and equal, and therefore we have to introduce equality and freedom, regardless of the cost, is that this one is Actonian one is different. It starts from roots and grows like a tree, like a language. It has a history, it has a tradition, and there it requires respect for it. Continental liberalism, or I would call it doctrinaire liberalism, do not have respect for tradition. Tradition is bad. Tradition is a record of evil history. We should reject it. Acton is different. I'm not sure if I'm clear, but
yeah, that makes. I mean, you know, it's clear to see that, you know, Acton is very much, or you know, very clearly influential then to, you know, Hayek, as you mentioned, Hayek, and you know, many of Hayek's ideas.
Hayek lived like 50, 60 years later. So he was either congenial or was using the thought of Acton, and he uses Acton extensively.
In Acton's lifetime, there was obviously, like our time right now, surges of nationalism, and calls for nationalism. What did Acton think of nationalism, particularly its relationship to liberalism?
Acton hated nationalism really with his guts. You know, that he said, I'm not sure if I will quote it from my memory, that it's a retrograde step in human history. It's worse than socialism. and socialism was really bad for him. Okay, so and nationalism was even worse. But why did he view nationalism this way? Well, let us remember that Acton is a historian of liberty. He's a lover of liberty, okay? One of the themes of my book is to explain how he understood liberty. Much of what I have said so far explains that, because for him, liberalism is an expression of liberty, but it requires active citizens, for instance, participation. I would say he would not be very happy with our rejection of politics or our escape to privacy. I can envision your future question, why he's actual today, but that would be one of his warnings. That in a sense, you know, one of the fundamental difference between doctrinaire liberalism and organic Octonian liberalism is that there is no this contradiction between individual and the community. Classical liberalism has that, you know, it views our liberty is limited by the requirements of public life. We can be as free as long as we encounter freedom of others. So even though we can recognize that others are equal to us, still this is someone who limits my liberty. Acton do not see this dilemma, contradiction. For him, individual is an active citizen. Therefore, he's involved in resolving problems that belongs to his community. Besides, he defines liberty as the right to do what one ought to do. The classical liberal definition is one is free to do whatever one wants, unless it encroaches liberty of others. Yes, here is a difference. I am member of the community, and therefore I participate in resolving daily mundane problems. So there is no contradiction. Acton reconciles the individual with the community. Well, his understanding of liberty is very Catholic, because he says, "What an ought to." Now, today, not many would agree with this definition. Perhaps the problem on the one hand, and on the other, what makes Acton fascinating, because he issues many warnings to us, you know, to posterity.
Why was Acton critical of democracy? What were his issues on that front?
Well, that's a tricky question, because you can easily compile, a few dozen of his pronouncements when he's extremely anti-democratic. On the other hand, this was something which I remember, you know, at the beginning of my research, I couldn't understand. On the one hand, the guy hates democracy. On the other hand, he agrees with the basic principles of democratic regime. That is, there is no doubt for him that sovereignty lies with the people. Not some. He's not a monarchist, you know, divine rights, whatever. No, he says power comes from the people from the beginning. Stresses there is no way there is no way community exists for any other reason than for the common good. Why do we live together? Why do we create community? For common good. Otherwise, we will just depart, you know? And of course, we compromise. We enter into many compromises. Security is one of the main. But still, it must be our common good. Therefore, we have the right to decide. We have to have a say. So, popular sovereignty. Then he accepts the rule of the majority. His pronouncement that would question it. So these are the most fundamental principles of democracy. He, of course, is aware that democracy needs limitations, needs restraints, needs to be limited. He hated unlimited democracy. Most of his remark about democracy is about Athenian democracy, which was unlimited democracy. But on the other hand, you know, when I mean my second book, the one that is published right now by Cornell, I realized that there is something else. I mean, on the one hand, I could claim, I could and could enter into a discussion with those who deny my claim that Acton, on the one hand, says democracy has the potential to be the best government if properly limited, constrained in all possible ways. On the other hand, unlike Aristotle, he says, it has a capacity to be the worst. Aristotle says that this is the bad regime, but it's the most lenient among the bad. Starting from tyranny, oligarchy, democracy. Democracy is the best among them. Acton is of different view. A democracy actually can lead us to a nightmare. And this is actually we are touching why I wrote on Acton for Our Time. That is, democracy today democracy is worshipped by most of our contemporaries, thinking that, along the church's line, who said that, democracy is a bad kind of regime, but no one invented better. Acton says that, no, it has a capacity to be the worst. Today we would call totalitarian and the best if properly framed.
You mentioned a little bit about Acton's history of liberty, looking at the ancient Israel and the Greeks. But are there any other aspects of the history of liberty
I don't want to spend too much time on it. I mean, anyone who is interested can go to the book and read it. Acton has that liberty has a history, starting from, he traces it to Israel, then shows it how it flourished in Greece, at the same time showing its negative side. He also shows it how it existed in the Roman Empire. The interesting thing is how he sees liberty in the Middle Ages. Because when we think about the Middle Ages, we usually do not think it as a period in which people were free. But he pays attention to one thing that, in the Middle Ages, central authority was limited. Restrained by very powerful forces, first the church and great lords. This was like a sort of medieval division of powers. And as long as they existed, they prevented the rise of absolutism. Absolutism was a result of, a reformation when Luther undermined. This is something which the British, the English would hate, or the Protestant would hate. But he stresses that Protestants subordinated the church to the state, and therefore opened the the path to absolutism. Anyway, he stresses that medieval political thought is proto-liberal. There are when he quotes Saint Augustine, Saint Thomas, he shows that certain ideas which were pronounced by them were rediscovered by liberal thought when, as he stresses, they were deprived of religious roots. The point is, however, what is important is that liberty has a history. It continues throughout Western history. Acton claims that liberty is a providential idea. That is, that this is an idea. Well, I mean, today that sounds odd, but that this is an idea that is propped up by God, and therefore cannot be destroyed. And if you try really try to destroy it, it has unexpected form. It has a form of corruption to prevent, to save the remnants of freedom. You know, I was shocked when I read it for the first time when he says corruption in the Russian Empire was the last resort, last bastion of freedom. Or, you know, I'm not sure how familiar you are with European history, French history. French absolutism led the judges to buy their offices. That was the idea that was conceived by Louis XIV, and during the next 150 years, this created a sort of a group that has a l'esprit de corps that defended their rights. And in a sense, judges that buy their offices is a synonym of corruption. And yet they were the last bastion of freedom in absolute France, pre-revolutionary France. So he says, freedom is a yearning of our heart. It comes from within. Human being cannot be deprived of it. And therefore, it would aim at it. It's a providential idea. That is why it has a history. I mean, we cannot assume that, well, people 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, didn't dream about freedom. We all dream about freedom as long as we are human beings.
After his death, how were his ideas received? What would you say was his legacy in the 20th century?
Well, Acton was fairly known. Though, of course, let us remember that it's a Victorian England, and when I say fairly known, it means in influential circles, you know. So he was known because he published, by that time, he published many articles, essays, and so intellectuals, intelligent readers read it, yes. He was not unknown person. Although, in 1895, he was appointed to be the Regius Professor of Modern History at Cambridge by the Queen of England. And
yeah, they finally let him in.
Pardon me?
They let him in, yes. After all.
I mean, and this was one of the most prestigious jobs for a historian. He became then better known to the public, to the students, as in university circles. I mean, there are many memoirs that mention that, you know, his lectures were so fascinating, the professor attended it. This is something which does not occur very often today, you know, that a college, well, you can go to a colleague, to a friend, but just to attend because it's a famous professor. By the time of his death, he was well known. Moreover, he also was, at that time, in his Cambridge years, he stressed that history is to be objective. So he was very modern in this respect. You know, he was, I mean, when you study methodology as a historian, Ranke, the German historian, is stressed as the one who stressed that one has to be objective as much as possible. Acton was, of course, chronologically later, but he was the one who brought Rankean thinking to England. At the time when he became a university professor, history was considered to be, well, a sort of helpful knowledge in diplomacy, in politics, but not knowledge in itself. And he made it, well, proudly says science, that we know today history is not science, but he tried to make history as objective as possible, saying that history of Europe, European history, let's say a German writes a French history, should be the same as the Frenchman writing history. And he initiated, he was the during his Cambridge years, the syndics of the Cambridge University endowed him with the task of writing modern history, modern European history, modern Western history, which was a 12-volume published after his death with his idea, you know, that history written not according to national lines, but regardless of national lines. It was a history of ideas, history of trends, changes, long-term processes that developed regardless of whether it's French, Germany, or England, or other, Italy. It was to be a general history. So this is his immortal contribution to history. There is no question about it. Now, so originally, after his death, he was recognized as a guru. I mean, he was admired, studied, and then 10 years later, gradually, fascination of Lord Ar- well, let us remember, he was a charismatic speaker. There are some memoirs of his students when he described how he looked, you know, his the timbre of his voice, his blue eyes, his beard, his large forehead. I mean, he was so imposing figure. When he spoke, there was complete silence, and he spoke in such a manner that the students felt that history is speaking to them, you know. So there is no question, he had charisma. Now, 10 years later, no one remembered that, and then this changed into the opposite. And actually, Professor Butterfly, Cambridge professor, who when he was young, he was still fascinating in Acton, and then he destroyed, I mean, he wrote some really, how to say it? You know, one is a professor and wants to make a career, wants to make a name for his own. Butterfly was that guy. I know that there are some of his students who defend his good name. I don't appreciate what he wrote. He slandered Acton and turned his former love into hate. And, you know, in his little booklet, that I call it booklet because it had about 100 pages and had a very small format. I had the electronic version of that book, and it has like 150 times he mentions Acton, and mostly in a very negative term, branding him as a Whiggish historian, which requires further explanation. I'm not sure if I have time to explain it, but in a sense, Whiggish historians is interpreted, defined in such a way that England is the sort of master country that show us the way to develop. And whatever is good, whatever was in England, should be followed by others. And whatever does not, is not progressive, is not positive. Now, Butterfly really contributed to the destruction of Acton Smith. So we had to wait until World War II, when suddenly there were predominantly German historians, German and Austrian historians, who Hayek was one of them, who rediscovered him and saw, gosh, he wrote, he warned us about something which has happened during World War II. Why didn't we listen to him? Now, my book is a book for our generation, which says that, well, Acton's book is not just about World War II. He warns us as well. He has a message for us as well. He warns us about permanent weaknesses of democracy, which, if it's combined with modern state and doctrinaire liberalism, can lead again to something that is like a totalitarian nightmare.
Is that sort of what you would say is the most relevant idea of his today? That's this kind of this warning.
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, as I said, this is the third book I wrote on him, and when I wrote it, I reread him again, and I thought, well, gosh, he's talking about our time. He's, of course, we are not at the point which he warned us against it. But if we do not come to our senses, we may end up with the nightmare he's describing. Well, he doesn't use the term totalitarian because it did not exist in his time. But he has two kinds of totalitarianism in mind. One, which is the sort of Soviet one or Nazi one, that is a brutal that destroys, exterminates its enemies, or another one that has the roots in utilitarianism that wants to make us happy, whether we like it or not, and knows better what is good for us. This is the message for us. I mean, I understand that Acton is not an easy reading. I try to make him as easy as possible, but I'm afraid that one without college education will have really, really difficulties in understanding, especially his history of freedom. So.
Well, Christopher, thank you so much for being guest on the New Books Network. The book is Lord Acton for Our Time. Thank you.
You're welcome.